Good morning, everyone, and welcome back to the Arizona Mirror, brought to you each week by Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm Lauren Vicker, your volunteer broadcaster, and this episode on Thursday, August 6th, 2026, will feature articles that appeared in the Arizona Mirror over the past week. Since this program airs only once a week, some of the articles may be a bit dated, and breaking stories may be added toward the end. The Arizona Mirror is an independent publication which sources stories from all over the state and the nation. We focus primarily on stories that impact people in Arizona. In this week's episode, these are some of the stories we'll be reading. Arizona says judge turned to, quote, last resort fix for prison health care too soon. Critics say Protect Girls Sports Act will lead to intrusive bathroom policing. The Trump administration's draconian water cuts could gut Arizona's Colorado River supply. Bid to freeze Arizona's Secure the Border Act fails, but fight isn't over. And let's get started. Our first story, Arizona says judge turned to last resort fix for prison health care too soon. Plaintiffs counter that 14 years of fines, contempt orders, and inmate deaths left no other option. By Jim Small, August 4, 2026. The Hobbs administration says a federal judge went for the nuclear option too soon when she turned over control of the state's prison health care system to a receiver without exhausting other remedies in a lawsuit that has dragged on for 14 years and is asking the judge to pause doing so. Jumping from the current tools that are yielding measurable results to the receivership order's remedy of last resort before employing any intermediate measures is an abuse of discretion, Arizona Department of Corrections, Rehabilitation, and Reentry attorney Mary O'Grady wrote in a brief aiming to persuade Judge Roslyn Silver to issue a stay on her July order appointing Annette Chambers Smith to oversee the system. Since ruling in 2022 that the healthcare system in Arizona prisons is so substandard that it amounts to a violation of the Eighth Amendment rights of inmates, the state has only had about 3 years to comply with the terms of an injunction that the Corrections Department and the plaintiffs in the class action lawsuit agreed to. Since it made its constitutional findings, the court has not attempted to improve compliance through any intermediate measures, such as remedial plans or sanctions, O'Grady argued. In July, Silver appointed Chambers Smith and granted her the sole power to determine what the state needs to do to stop violating the constitutional rights of inmates. The plaintiffs, represented by the ACLU Foundation of Arizona and Prison Law Office, said it is outrageous that the Department of Corrections would argue that the court skips steps and that its legal position effectively attempts to hand wave away the myriad failures of the system that were documented prior to the 2022 injunction. Prior to that injunction, Prison Law Office attorney Sophie Hart wrote, "The court did escalate its attempts to bring the state into compliance through fines, contempt orders, expert evaluations, and a trial." Ultimately, she argued, the injunction did not fundamentally alter what the department is required to do. And Silver, Hart noted, has previously rejected the state's attempt to reframe evaluation of its compliance by ignoring what happened before 2022 as a, quote, profound misunderstanding of the law and facts. The class action lawsuit stretches back to 2012, when prisoners sued the department and alleged that its shoddy health care violated their Eighth Amendment right against cruel and unusual punishment. The 14 years since have been marked by escalating judicial intervention, culminating in Silver ordering the prison healthcare system into receivership. In 2014, the prisoners and the state reached a 103-point agreement on healthcare performance. But when the Corrections Department repeatedly failed to comply with those standards, the court twice held the agency in contempt and levied fines totaling more than $2.5 million. Following a 15-day bench trial in 2022, the court issued a 200-page order declaring the healthcare system pervasively and systemically unconstitutional. The next year, a permanent injunction was issued with specific quality indicators to assess how the prison system was complying with the court's directives. In 2024 and 2025, Silver wrote, the state repeatedly and flagrantly violated those orders, and a pilot program aimed at testing a new model for prison health care failed disastrously. It was only partially implemented at one of the two test sites and was only in place for 8 days before it was scrapped. The court's patience has run out. Too many individuals are needlessly suffering while defendants have deployed many delay tactics, Silver wrote in a February order placing the healthcare system into receivership. The court has exercised restraint for much of this litigation to the point that any more tolerance of unconstitutional healthcare becomes judicial indulgence. But the Corrections Department said that Silver asked the wrong question. Instead of focusing on whether the department has complied with the injunction, she should have asked whether a receiver is the only way to achieve compliance. Will a receivership achieve compliance more quickly and effectively than the remedies already in place? Plaintiff's opposition eludes that question, O'Grady argued. The plaintiffs, who asked Silver to appoint a receiver, said that after nearly 15 years of litigation and ongoing failures of the healthcare system, including documented deaths as a result, the answer to either question leads to the same result. The state has consistently refused to do what it has been ordered to do and has proven it won't take the steps needed to comply. The crux of the Correction Department's argument is that allowing the receiver to take the reins now while the state appeals the receivership order results in irreparable harm and violates the principles of federalism by stripping the state of its inherent authority. While the plaintiffs have argued that $2.2 million in contempt fines can be used to pay for the receiver during the appeal, the Department of Corrections noted that the costs are likely to far exceed that. O'Grady pointed to California, where a judge put its prison healthcare system into receivership more than 20 years ago, which spent more than $180 million on its receiver in the first 5 years, ranging from $11 million to $93 million in a single year. And on top of that, the state argued, using the contempt fines to pay for the receiver would actually create irreparable harm because those fines were designed to be coercive and the Corrections Department can still recover them through compliance. But if that money gets spent on a receiver, that ability goes away if the appeals court reverses Silver's order. O'Grady also argued that Silver also irreparably harms Arizona's authority because rather than temporarily enjoining state officials from enforcing their enacted policies, the receivership displaces the official's authority altogether. Anytime a state is enjoined by a court from effectuating statutes, it suffers a form of irreparable injury, she wrote. There is also the broader issue of the money needed to comply with the litigation. Although Governor Katie Hobbs initially proposed more than $118 million in new funding for compliance, but the final budget she negotiated with the Republicans who control the state legislature provides only about a third of that, and $45 million of that money is contingent on the Corrections Department and its private healthcare vendor, NAFCARE, signing a contract amendment with automatic penalties for persistent job vacancies. That amendment is not yet in place, but an ADCRR spokesman told the Arizona Mirror that the agency is currently working through the contract amendment process with NAFCARE. The Department of Corrections also said that Silver relied too heavily on inmate deaths due to poor medical care. Evaluating a system serving 25,000 patients by reference to its worst outcomes will inevitably overstate system-wide risk, O'Grady argued. If that method were sound, any time inadequate medical care is provided in a correctional setting, the entire correction system would be exposed to court-managed institutional reform. But Hart counted that the court's methodology went far beyond merely documenting the deaths, and it was based on the state's own self-reported compliance data. Defendants do not dispute this evidence. Instead, they take aim at this court's analysis, she wrote. And that concludes this first story. Arizona says judge turned to last resort fix for prison health care too soon. Next up, critics say Protect Girls Sports Act will lead to intrusive bathroom policing. By Gloria Rebecca Gomez, August 3, 2026. Arizonans will decide in November whether schools should scrutinize who uses which bathrooms during school sports events. Republicans have framed it as a safety issue, while critics warn it will only lead to intrusive policing and humiliation. For the past several years, Republicans across the country have pushed discriminatory policies barring transgender people from using public facilities and participating in athletic activities consistent with their gender identity. In Arizona, that resulted in a 2022 law prohibiting trans students from joining girls' sports teams. This year, GOP lawmakers in the Grand Canyon State are hoping voters will agree to exclude trans kids even more by threatening schools and athletic associations with lawsuits if they allow trans girls to join school sports teams or allow them, during sporting events, to use bathrooms, locker rooms, or school showers that align with their gender identity. Joel Edman, the Strategic Initiatives Director for Progress Arizona, said the ballot measure titled Protect Girls Sports in Arizona Act does not live up to its name and will instead lead to increased scrutiny of all students. The negative impacts this would have, not only on trying to bully and shame transgender people of all ages back into the closets, into the shadows, but also to enforce a stereotype of what girls are supposed to dress and act like, he said. The real risk that this measure poses is having all girls potentially scrutinized for being too tall or too strong or too good at whatever sport they want to play with their friends. Progress Arizona, through a political action committee, sought to convince a court to throw out the ballot measure, also known as Prop 318, arguing that it violates the requirements in the Arizona Constitution that mandate ballot measures keep to one subject and clearly define its content in the title. The group argued that the proposal covers too much because it details how school sports teams must be separated by gender and regulates the use of school facilities during athletic events. But Maricopa County Superior Court Judge Gregory Como disagreed, ruling that all of its provisions work toward the same goal, limiting the freedom of transgender students to participate in athletics, whether on the court or in school facilities used during athletic events. Opponents of the ballot measure fear that it will go beyond regulating where students can go, ensnaring members of the public. The proposal expressly forbids athletic associations, schools, and school employees from allowing anyone to use a restroom, locker room, shower room, or other space that isn't, quote, designated for that individual's sex. Edmund noted that means schools would need to police parents and other visitors, too. Imagine there's a fan, a family member supporting the students at a basketball game who needs to go use the restroom, he said. The measure would seem to require that those restrooms, because they are connected to an athletic facility or event, would have to be strictly gender policed. Even people just there for an hour or two watching a sporting event. And it's unclear how that would be accomplished for students or members of the public visiting the bathroom during sporting events. While the ballot measure makes the separation of school sports teams by gender reliant on birth certificates, no such criteria is included for how school employees are expected to figure out who is allowed into which bathroom. But the threat of a lawsuit if an athlete feels they've suffered direct or indirect harm because of school or athletic association knowingly violating the directive to police school facilities still applies. And that concludes this second story. Critics say Protect Girls Sports Act will lead to intrusive bathroom policing. Our next story, the Trump administration's draconian water cuts could gut Arizona's Colorado River supply. Hobbs says the reductions threaten farms, chip makers, and national security as the state weighs its legal options. By Caitlin Sievers, July 31, 2026. A new federal plan released Friday could mean cuts of up to 77% to Arizona's share of Colorado River water in the midst of a 25-year mega drought, something that state leaders say would cause catastrophic harm to the state's economy. Such reductions would devastate Arizona's water users and its economy, the Arizona Department of Water Resources said in a statement denouncing the plan. The lower basin states, Arizona, Nevada, and California, and the upper basin states, Colorado, New Mexico, Wyoming, and Utah, have been attempting to negotiate an updated water usage agreement for more than 2 years. So far, they've been unsuccessful. For many months, it has been clear that the direction of Colorado River negotiations has been an exercise in lowering expectations, particularly for a long-term seven-state agreement on operating this vital river system, ADWR said in the statement. The Colorado River is a vital source of drinking water for 40 million people in the seven states, Mexico, and 30 Native American tribes, and it provides water for farming operations and hydroelectricity. All seven states were parties to the Colorado River Compact, a 1922 agreement governing the river's water use that allocates 7.5 million acre-feet of water each year to be shared by the upper basin states, and another 7.5 million to be used among the lower basin states. An acre-foot of water is enough to cover an acre of land to a depth of 1 foot, or about 325,851 gallons. That's enough to provide 3 homes in Arizona a year of water on average. Since forming the compact, the states have updated their water usage guidelines several times, even though the apportionments remain the same. But lower basin states face cuts mandated by the federal government during times of drought, and upper basin states do not. The existing water usage rules expire at the end of the year, so setting new rules is imperative to the states as the river's water supply continues to decline due to a 25-year drought spurred on by climate change. Water officials in Arizona and the lower basin states have criticized the upper basin states for their refusal to agree to any federally mandated water usage cuts of their own. While the lower basin states insist that every state take their fair share of cuts, upper basin states have argued that they've never used their full allotment and already face regular cuts and shortages based on physical availability of water. Riley Snow, director of the Water Law Department at Rose Law Group, told the Arizona Mirror that he viewed the Upper Basin's refusal to take mandatory cuts as a, quote, tragedy of the commons. "I just don't feel like it's good policy," he said. "It's not good for the Southwest, essentially, especially Arizona and California, to not get what they're entitled to under the compact just because the Upper Basin is in a drought and feeling like they need to hold on to everything that they can." Arizona faces an outsized burden when it comes to reductions because the Central Arizona Project, a series of canals that supplies Colorado River water to the Valley and the Tucson area, is one of the newest uses of the river water, making it legally one of the first to be cut. But Snow says now isn't the time for Arizonans to panic, as the state has prepared for potential Colorado River cuts via groundwater banking and increased efficiency. Beyond that, 70% of the state's water goes toward agriculture, where adopting more efficient practices, fallowing land, and growing less thirsty crops could make a big difference. After negotiations with the Upper Basin were unfruitful earlier this year, the Lower Basin states in May offered their own proposal to reduce their share usage by 1.25 million acre-feet annually in 2027 and 2028, with about a 30% cut for Arizona. This proposal was aimed at helping to stabilize water levels in Lake Powell and Lake Mead, the system's two key reservoirs, whose water levels fell this month to their lowest level since 1957. Without a major turnaround in hydrologic conditions, water levels in Lake Powell are expected to fall by next spring to below, quote, minimum power pool, at which point the Glen Canyon Dam's hydroelectric turbines would be unable to operate. The Trump administration's preferred alternative plan, part of an environmental impact statement released Friday, could reduce the Lower Basin's allocation by 3 million acre-feet per year, slashing Arizona's water supply from the river by more than 75%. But there's still a possibility that the federal government could implement the Lower Basin's proposal instead. The federal government's new river usage rules, which are still being negotiated, will be released later this year. While this federal environmental impact statement still contains unacceptable options that include the federal government forcing Arizona to take the majority of draconian water cutbacks, implementing the Lower Basin Agreement would protect Arizona from massive water cuts, distribute reductions more fairly across the Lower Basin states, and provide stability and protection to the water supply that our communities rely on, Governor Katie Hobbs said in a statement. In March, Arizona retained the high-powered law firm Sullivan and Cromwell to represent the state in possible litigation among the Colorado River Basin states and the federal government. But Snow, who represents water law clients in both Arizona and Utah, told the Mirror that he doesn't see any litigation in the immediate future. Instead, he said that Arizona and the other Lower Basin states should focus on convincing the Trump administration to implement the proposal they presented in May and to put some federal funding behind it. After that, he said, the states can come together to create a long-term seven-state solution. Hobbs said forcing Arizona to take on such devastating cuts will have repercussions across the American economy and national security. Arizona provides the agricultural produce, critical minerals, weapons defense systems, and cutting-edge semiconductors that feed America, protect America, and fuel America's high-tech economy, Hobbs said in the statement. No other state in the Colorado River Basin can say the same. We developed the Lower Basin proposal to increase water resiliency for the region and ensure that no single state was bearing the burden alone. Arizona politicians from across the political spectrum released statements on Friday agreeing that the state shouldn't bear the brunt of the cuts without sacrifice from other basin states. Arizona recognizes the serious condition of the Colorado River, and we are prepared to be part of a responsible solution, Arizona Senate President Warren Peterson said in a statement. What we will not accept is a federal plan that protects some states while placing a devastating and disproportionate burden on Arizona. Our state has already conserved enormous amounts of water and made difficult sacrifices to protect this river. Arizona Senate Democrats urged the federal government to build its rule for 2027 and 2028 around the Lower Basin proposal. Water is the foundation of our communities and our economy, Senate Democratic Whip Rosanna Gabaldon said in a statement. Our farmers, tribal nations, businesses, and families have worked for decades to use water responsibly. Arizona should not be punished for leading on conservation while others refuse to do their part. And with that, we conclude this story. The Trump administration's draconian water cuts could gut Arizona's Colorado River supply. Next, we turn to election 2026. Andy Biggs chooses Sina Kerr for running mate, leaning into rural Arizona. The former lawmaker returned to public life last year as the Trump administration's State Farm Service Agency director. By Jim Small, July 31, 2026. Andy Biggs, the GOP nominee for governor, picked former state legislator Sina Kerr as his running mate, announcing on Friday that she was his choice for lieutenant governor. Kerr, a dairy farmer from Buckeye, was appointed to the Arizona Senate in 2018 to fill a vacancy. She then went on to win three full terms in office. In 2024, she did not seek re-election. In May 2025, she was appointed by the Trump administration to serve as the state executive director of the USDA Farm Service Agency. The Biggs campaign touted that Kerr's mother is a naturalized citizen from Mexico and praised her legislative background. She's worked across the aisle to get things done at the legislature, from spearheading the successful passage of the 2022 Water Protection Bill to her sponsorship of Cayley's Law, a landmark piece of legislation that protects victims of sex crimes from being harassed or contacted by their abuser, Biggs said in a written statement announcing her selection. Arizona voters created the position of lieutenant governor in 2022, and this is the first time gubernatorial nominees are tasked with selecting a running mate who would succeed them if they cannot finish their four-year term. Arizona's rural communities have come under attack from Democratic Katie Hobbs and her allies, prioritizing the demands of ideologues over protecting our state's agriculture community, Kerr said in a statement. Rural Arizona will always have a seat at the table in a Biggs-Kerr administration, and I'm looking forward to rallying rural communities across the state to deliver a win for Andy Biggs in November. Like Biggs, Kerr is stridently anti-abortion. In 2021, she pushed legislation that would have banned nearly all abortions in Arizona, even those caused by rape or incest. The so-called heartbeat proposal would have criminalized abortions performed if a fetal heartbeat is detected. A heartbeat can often be detected as early as 6 weeks, before many women even know they are pregnant. Governor Katie Hobbs, the incumbent Democrat who is seeking re-election, panned Biggs' pick as out of touch with what Arizona voters want this election. All you need to know about Sina Kerr is that she is so extreme, she agreed to be the running mate of Andy Biggs, a Washington insider who sided with a corrupt pedophile cult, shielded sex traffickers, covered for Jeffrey Epstein, stood with the powerful and well-connected, and backed policies that raised grocery and gas costs for Arizona families, said Nicole DeMont, Hobbs' campaign manager. Stacey Pearson, a Democratic campaign consultant, said Kerr will face tough questions about her legislative record that will show she and Biggs stand at odds with most Arizonans. Andy Biggs doubled down on extremism with this pick, she said. Republicans were lukewarm about Biggs' decision to pick Kerr, particularly because she doesn't help him attract new supporters. Choosing her, said GOP political consultant Barrett Marson, shows that Biggs made his choice with a primary eye toward having a successor who would continue his policy goals, instead of bringing new groups of voters into his camp. She doesn't expand the possibility of attracting new constituency, Marson said. It's a fine pick, but it won't blow voters away. Chuck Coughlin, a veteran lobbyist and political consultant who has worked on multiple Republican gubernatorial campaigns, called Kerr, quote, a curious pick for lieutenant governor. Biggs had an opportunity to appeal to moderate Republicans and right-of-center independent voters who don't like Donald Trump, but instead chose a running mate who is cut from the same conservative cloth and works for Trump. I don't think it adds anything to the political constituency Biggs needs to win a statewide campaign, he said, adding that Biggs already has strong support in rural Arizona and among the agriculture industry. I don't see how this adds electability. And it could backfire, Coughlin said. During her time as a state legislator, Kerr was, quote, a substantial impediment to finding a solution to the state's growing groundwater crisis. The result is wide swaths of Arizona where there is no regulation on how much water people or companies can pump out of the ground. With the news Friday that Arizona is facing steep cuts to its Colorado River allotment, water is fast becoming a top priority for voters. And Coughlin said Biggs has now effectively declared that his administration will back policies that maintain the status quo. Hobbs has until September 4th to pick her running mate. According to the New York Times and others, Hobbs floated the possibility of offering the gig to Jimmy McCain, the son of the late U.S. Senator John McCain and former Republican Mesa Mayor John Giles. Both reportedly declined. And that concludes this story. Andy Biggs chooses Sina Kerr for running mate, leaning into rural Arizona. A reminder that you're listening to the Arizona Mirror, brought to you each week by Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm Lauren Vicker, your volunteer broadcaster. Moving to our next story, bid to freeze Arizona's Secure the Border Act fails, but fight isn't over. Backers say the challenge came too early because no one has been arrested. Critics warn of discriminatory policing. By Gloria Rebecca Gomez, July 31, 2026. An attempt to temporarily block an Arizona law allowing state officials to jail immigrants failed, but there's still a chance that opponents could pause the law's implementation, though when that might happen and whether it will be too late to prevent any arrests is unclear. Earlier this month, the Florence Immigrant and Refugee Rights Project, a nonprofit that frequently provides free legal defense for people facing deportation proceedings, filed a lawsuit against Proposition 314, urging a federal court to stop it from going into effect. The ballot measure, known as the Secure the Border Act, won 61% of the vote in 2024. It includes a provision that makes the act of crossing the state's southern border without authorization anywhere but at an official port of entry a Class 1 misdemeanor, which carries with it up to 6 months in jail. Local law enforcement officers would be empowered to arrest people they suspect of making unauthorized crossings, and Arizona judges would be able to issue deportation orders, virtually overriding the federal immigration system. The sweeping changes to immigration enforcement didn't go into effect until July 14th, because Republican lawmakers tied the law's implementation to a similar law in Texas, which was only recently revived by a federal appeals court. According to Arizona Attorney General Chris Mays, who's defending the law in court, that means that only people who cross into the state on or after that date can be convicted of a crime. But attorneys for the American Civil Liberties Union, which is representing the Florence Project, argue that the law negatively impacts the organization's work and poses too high a risk of resulting in discriminatory policing. The ACLU requested a temporary restraining order to prevent the law from being implemented. A judge rejected that request. Amanda Molingo, a spokesperson for the Arizona chapter of the ACLU, lamented the unapproved TRO, but noted that there's still hope because the court has yet to consider whether a preliminary injunction is warranted. Unlike a TRO, which lasts just 14 days, a preliminary injunction can hold a law at bay throughout the length of litigation. But debate over whether that should happen is still days away. A scheduling hearing has been set for August 11th, and that will likely be when the court will pick a date to hear arguments on the question of whether to grant a preliminary injunction. Until then, Prop 314 is in effect, and anyone who crosses Arizona's southern border without authorization is at risk of being thrown into state criminal proceedings. While a preliminary injunction is a critical stopgap to minimize the impact of the Secure the Border Act, the ultimate goal of the two civil rights groups is to convince the court that the provision enhancing Arizona's role in immigration enforcement unlawfully conflicts with the authority of the federal government and should be permanently blocked. ACLU attorneys likely face an uphill battle to prove that argument, however. Both Mays and Republican state legislative leaders Warren Peterson and Steve Montenegro are backing the law in court. The trio assert that the Florence Project's lawsuit was filed too early and that the nonprofit doesn't have the right to issue a legal challenge at all because there is no actual violation to discuss. No one has been arrested under the law yet, and the claims that the Florence Project's work will be upended as it seeks to provide legal aid to as many people as possible doesn't constitute a harm that the court should address. Any time a state creates a new crime, it could result in lawyers having to adjust in myriad ways, including by complicating practice, representing more or fewer clients, incurring greater transportation or administrative costs, and undertaking hiring or training efforts, Mays wrote in her response objecting to a TRO. Plaintiff's speculative allegations do not meet the constitutional threshold to show that it is likely to suffer any injury or that any injury it may suffer is caused by Proposition 314, echoed Peterson and Montenegro. Similar arguments ultimately led to the dismissal of the case against the Texas law earlier this year. A federal appeals court ruled that the two Texas-based legal advocacy organizations that filed the lawsuit didn't have a right to launch a legal challenge, despite their arguments that the law significantly hindered their ability to provide services to immigrants. But Molindo said that's not enough to rule out the Florence Project's claims, pointing out that outcomes in the Arizona court system don't rely on conclusions from another. Legal analysis from one circuit to the next can differ, she said. And that concludes this story. Bid to freeze Arizona's Secure the Border Act fails, but fight isn't over. Our next story, Medicaid work rules move forward as judge denies bid from AZ other states to halt them. Between 3 and 7 million people could lose coverage under requirements tied to work, school, or volunteering. By Nada Hassanin, July 31, 2026. States will have to meet a January 1 deadline to implement new Medicaid work requirements after a federal judge denied 25 Democratic-led states' requests to pause implementation of the rule. The broad tax and spending law President Donald Trump signed last summer, the One Big Beautiful Bill Act, requires states that have expanded Medicaid to cover more adults under the Affordable Care Act, 42 states plus the District of Columbia, to mandate that those adults work, go to school, or volunteer for at least 80 hours a month to keep their coverage. On June 29th, the Democratic-led states sued the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, CMS, and the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, HHS, taking aim at new federal guidance published earlier that month that narrows the definition of who can qualify as, quote, medically frail. That designation excuses Medicaid recipients from work requirements if they have serious disabilities or illnesses. The plaintiffs argue that the new exemption is too narrow and would force patients with severe illnesses and disabilities to, quote, jump through unnecessary administrative hoops to keep their coverage. They also asserted that implementation would be costly and time-consuming, and noted that the new guidance came months after they'd already begun consulting with federal government on how to implement the work requirements. But United States District Judge Richard Stearns of Massachusetts noted in a ruling issued on Wednesday that CMS has said it will reimburse states for 90% of the costs associated with designing and executing the requirements. Stearns said he wasn't convinced that states would be unable to cover the remaining 10% and pointed out that the January 1 deadline was set by Congress, not CMS. Because injunctive relief is the exception, not the rule, there is a certain point at which damages fail to justify the issuance of such an extraordinary measure, he wrote. Plaintiffs have not shown that their damages rise above that minimal threshold here. Moreover, the additional costs that may be incurred by the states are unlikely to bloom disproportionately given the familiarity of the responsible state agencies with the tasks to be performed. The court acknowledged that the case presents, quote, difficult issues about the scope of what Congress delegated to HHS. It also raises questions about CMS Administrator Dr. Mehmet Oz's faithfulness to congressional intent, the judge wrote. Between 3 million and 7 million people could lose coverage as a result of the new work requirements, the Urban Institute estimated earlier this year. With the addition of more frequent eligibility checks, up to 10 million people could lose coverage over the next decade. Along with the governors of Kentucky and Pennsylvania, the complaint was brought by Democratic Attorneys General of Arizona, California, Colorado, Connecticut, Delaware, the District of Columbia, Hawaii, Illinois, Maine, Maryland, Massachusetts, Michigan, Minnesota, Nevada, New Jersey, New Mexico, New York, North Carolina, Oregon, Rhode Island, Vermont, Virginia, Washington, and Wisconsin. That concludes this story. Medicaid work rules move forward as judge denies bid from AZ, other states to halt them. Our next story, High Court says churches, not judges, define a, quote, confession when it comes to reporting child abuse. Advocates warn the broad ruling lets predators use a confessional loophole to escape justice. By Jared McDonald, Evoy, July 30th, 2026. And there's a note here. This story deals with sexual abuse and assault of minors. If you or someone you know has been a victim of this crime, call 800-656-HOPE, H-O-P-E, for 24/7 help and support. The Arizona Supreme Court sided with religious leaders this week who argue that the state's clergy penitence privilege law shielded them from reporting child sexual abuse to authorities. And in declaring that any intervention by the courts would violate the First Amendment, the justices made clear they don't think any changes to Arizona law aimed at forcing clergy to report abuse would be constitutional. We hold that the First Amendment generally prohibits fact finders from inquiring into a clergy member's application of his particular religious doctrine in determining whether reporting should be withheld if reasonable and necessary. Vice Chief Justice John R. Lopez IV wrote in the court's unanimous opinion, "The First Amendment requires courts to exercise substantial deference to a religious institution's own doctrinal conception of confession or confidential communication." Advocates for abused children say they were disappointed in the ruling. "The protection of children is paramount," said Angela Walker, the executive director of the Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests, "and should take precedence over church doctrine. We do not want predators to be able to use this confessional loophole to escape justice," she said. "While we respect the court's decision, we believe that the safety of these children must be protected, especially since predator videoed these images and put them online." In Arizona, clergy are not mandated reporters, and suspected child abuse or neglect isn't exempted from that, even if it is ongoing. And religious leaders cannot be forced to testify in court about abuse a parishioner confessed to committing. The case, Doe versus the Corporation of the President of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, revolved around how Paul Adams disclosed to church leaders that he had sexually abused all six of his children for years. Adams, a Customs and Border Patrol officer in Bisbee, was arrested in 2017 after he posted videos of himself abusing his children online. Adams confessed the abuse in 2010 to his bishop, John Herod, who in turn called a church abuse helpline, which told him he should not mention the abuse to any authorities. The case was featured prominently in an Associated Press investigation that found the helpline created by The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints often steered those reporting abuse away from legal authorities and instead to attorneys representing the church in order to cover up abuse allegations. Three of Adams' children eventually filed a lawsuit against the church in 2021, claiming that it had covered up the abuse. Adams was excommunicated from the church and committed suicide while in custody after confessing to his crimes. The LDS Church argued that it was not bound by Arizona's law requiring people report child abuse because of an exemption for clergy who receive the information in a confession or confidential communication from a parishioner. A Cochise County Superior Court judge agreed and granted the church's motion for summary judgment in its favor. An appeals court reversed that, concluding that Adams' clergy penitent privilege was, quote, waived when Herod had Adams repeat his confession to a church disciplinary board and before his wife, Liza. It ruled that a jury should be allowed to determine whether the privilege was waived and whether the church followed its own internal handbook advising leaders on how or whether to report abuse. But the Supreme Court on Thursday said the appellate panel was wrong to do so. First, it ruled that the clergy penitent privilege is a testimonial privilege, dealing only with whether a clergy member can be forced to testify, and is therefore irrelevant to any duty to report abuse. So whether it was waived or not doesn't impact whether the bishops had a duty to report. That duty is determined by the clergy exemption in the reporting statute. And whether that exemption is invoked is fully up to the judgment of the clergy member and the church, Lopez wrote. The First Amendment bars a jury from evaluating whether the bishops followed their own religious doctrine in deciding not to report, the Supreme Court ruled, because the courts must defer to a church's own characterization of what counts as a confession and what its doctrine requires. This broad interpretive deference also avoids the potential for government coercion that could arise from a narrower construction of the legislature's language, Lopez wrote. In this case, the LDS Church's determination that Adams' admissions before the disciplinary council amounted to a confession or a confidential communication cannot be judged by the court. Given the Church's classification of Adams' abuse as violating the laws of God and the Church's assertion that Paul's admissions to Bishop Herod, alone and in Lieza's presence, were confessions, we conclude that Adams' admission to Bishop Herod constituted confessions for the purpose of reporting statute, Lopez wrote. Any further inquiry into whether Paul's admissions qualify as confessions is explicitly doctrinal. Under the First Amendment, such inquiry is beyond the purview of the fact finder and thus leaves no genuine issue of material fact regarding whether Paul's admissions to Bishop Herod qualified as, quote, confessions. The case attracted briefs from a litany of other religious bodies and institutions, including the Roman Catholic Church, the Seventh-day Adventist Church, and the Beckett Fund for Religious Liberty. Several have their own baggage in regards to failing to report sexual abuse. The Roman Catholic Diocese of Phoenix, Tucson, and Gallup backed the LDS Church's position and argued that a ruling in favor of the Adams children violated the First Amendment. All three dioceses have faced allegations that they covered up sexual abuse by their clergy. In the early 2000s, the Tucson Diocese filed for bankruptcy due to litigation over instances of abuse within the church. The Church of Scientology, which has faced allegations of covering up child sexual abuse and forced marriages, made a similar filing alongside a litany of other religious institutions that also included the Seventh-day Adventist Church. That church has also faced allegations of child sexual abuse dating back to the 1970s. The broad First Amendment ruling could limit whether Arizona law could be changed to require church leaders to report abuse, as other states have done. SNAP has been working across the country to change the laws that Walker said protect predators. SNAP feels strongly that law enforcement should be contacted when a crime is committed. In this particular case, several different denominations circled the wagons in order to protect the Mormon Church, rather than protecting the children who should have been saved from a predator, she said, adding that one of SNAP's pillars is advocating to reform archaic predator-friendly laws that allow abuse and cover-ups to continue. Bipartisan efforts to change or reform Arizona's clergy-penitent privilege law have failed to gain traction over fears it would lead to the government interfering with confessions. Miranda Whitworth, the adopted mother of one of the children taken from Adams' home, spoke out in favor of one such bill in 2021 and described the horrors the child witnessed and endured in the home, including seeing family pets run over or mutilated, as a threat to speaking up about abuse. We strongly feel that protecting children against sexual predators is first and foremost the priority, and that we believe that the majority of people in Arizona will stand with us as well, Walker said of the ongoing efforts at reforming such laws. It seems pretty clear-cut, and I think the majority of Americans agree. And that concludes this story. High Court says churches, not judges, define a confession when it comes to reporting child abuse. And one more note before we wrap up. Trump's mail voting order would disenfranchise voters and create mass confusion, states warn SCOTUS. 24 Democratic officials want the stay kept in place through Election Day. By Jacob Fischler, August 4, 2026. States do not have time before November's midterm elections to comply with President Donald Trump's executive order mandating overhauls of their mail-in voting systems, 24 Democratic state officials told the U.S. Supreme Court on Monday. Justices should keep a stay, pausing the order in place through Election Day, the Democrats, led by California Attorney General Rob Bonta, wrote. The court is compelled to keep voting rules in place this close to an election, but the executive order would force massive changes on state administrators, they wrote. Neither the president nor the U.S. Postal Service has the authority to administer elections under the U.S. Constitution, which assigns that responsibility to state governments, the Democrats wrote. Trump's March 31 order directs USPS to collect lists of registered voters from each state and only mail ballots to registered voters, and the Department of Homeland Security to compile lists of voting age citizens in each state. That would insert the executive branch directly into elections administration, and the administration has not defended the legality of that move, the Democrats wrote. Worse, the officials said, the order would create mass confusion at this point in the election cycle, meaning that the court should delay considering whether it is legal until after the midterms. Because of the high risk of errors and the limited window for correcting mistakes, many of the millions of voters who rely on mail voting, especially voters with disabilities and those in rural areas, would likely be denied mail ballots and, as a result, disenfranchised, the state officials wrote. Many more voters would be confused, either because they wouldn't receive their mail ballots or would fear that USPS would fail to deliver their voted ballots to state officials for tabulation. Bonta signed the brief along with the attorneys general of Massachusetts, Washington, Nevada, Arizona, Connecticut, Colorado, the District of Columbia, Delaware, Hawaii, Illinois, Maine, Maryland, Michigan, Minnesota, New Jersey, New Mexico, New York, North Carolina, Oregon, Rhode Island, Vermont, Virginia, and Wisconsin. Pennsylvania Governor Josh Shapiro also signed on. And we're going to have to leave it there because that's all the time we have for this August 6, 2026 edition of the Arizona Mirror, brought to you each week by Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm Lauren Vicker, your volunteer broadcaster. Remember, if you missed any part of this program or want to hear a story again, you can go to our website, sunsounds.org, and click on on-demand podcasts. And you can also get our stream and on-demand podcasts on our Sun Sounds of Arizona app for Apple and Android phones, or hear Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or smart home device. Thanks so much for joining us this week. Stay tuned for more great programming from Sun Sounds of Arizona, and we'll look forward to having you join us next week.